www.rc.org. And remember to check out the Words and Culture website for more episodes on Indigenous languages. I'm Michael Hutchinson. Thank you for listening. Be well. Stay smiling.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e minen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kako utau. We'll see you again.
This is Bird Note. If we think of pink birds, flamingos and spoonbills might come to mind. But gulls and terns can also have glowing pink breasts. We picture these seaside birds decked out in their standard colors of gray, white, and black. Yet several gull and tern species greet spring with a rosy blush on their breasts. Franklin's gulls, flying north to nest in the prairie wetlands, glow reddish pink below, flashy enough that in the 19th century the bird was known as Franklin's rosy gull. The laughing gull, common along the Atlantic and Gulf coasts, may also show a suffusion of pink. The pinkest of all this group are roseate terns, which have some pink all year, but reach their showiest at the start of the breeding season. This is true of all pink-breasted gulls. The rosy glow, present in both males and females, may signal that the birds are ready to pair up and begin breeding and nesting. That pink blush ultimately comes from pigments in the bird's food called carotenoids. These naturally occurring pigments may enhance their success at attracting a mate and help foster the next generation of the rosy-breasted. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Got a small appliance that's broken? Maybe an electronic product that's broken? Or just an item of clothing that has one too many holes? Join the Repair Cafe event held by SPEC in partnership with the City of Vancouver down at the West End Community Center on Saturday, June 22nd, between 9:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Get involved and do your part in reducing waste. And if you bring your own mug, there's free coffee and tea. Head over to spec.bc.ca/events for more information.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
Deloanne, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The upcoming Jai Jamboree Cultural Celebration in the Nisga'a village of Lac La Zap is set for June 14th and 15th. It will showcase Indigenous culture and community unity. Bobby Clark, Chief Administrative Officer of Lac La Zap Village Government, shared insights into the event's inception and its role in preserving traditional song and dance, particularly during the salmon harvest season.
Bobby Clark, the Chief Administrative Officer with Lac La Zap Village Government.
The Jai Jamboree Cultural Celebration will be taking place in the Nisga'a village of Lac La Zap, June 14th and 15th. So what inspired the creation of the Jai Cultural Celebration?
So the Lac La Zap Cultural Dancers have been active since 1996 and really began to build momentum when we worked towards our trip to Hawaii last year. So we endeavored, it was a huge milestone that we had to work towards in terms of fundraising to make it a reality. But ultimately we wanted to take a major trip, and that involved a lot of fundraising and working together to make it a reality. So the Jai Jamboree was created approximately 2 years ago. So the first annual would have been in 2022, and we really thought of an opportunity to bring cultural dance groups together to keep song and dance alive throughout the year. As you know, we have OBA every February that is hosted in one of four Nisga'a villages each year. So aside from OBA, there was really nothing else within the Nass Valley that celebrates your song and dance. So we thought of an opportunity to bring community together and to bring dance groups together to really just to keep the culture strong and alive throughout the year.
The celebration is specifically for the return of the salmon, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So June is typically the month that we see the return of the salmon, starting with the sockeye and the spring salmon. So yeah, it's a change in the harvest season for Minnesota, where the smokehouses begin to be active again with preservation of salmon throughout the season.
And what can attendees expect from this year's celebration in terms of cultural performances, activities, community engagement?
So we'll have, it's over two days on the 14th and 15th of June, and we have a number of dance groups from within the Nisga'a Nation and also neighboring nations that are wanting to come and join in the celebration. So we'll have a lineup of performances throughout the 2 days. We'll also be inviting arts and crafts vendors, and yeah, just a time to gather. And of course, we'll be providing food as well. Fresh salmon, of course, is going to be a main menu item that everyone will have the opportunity to enjoy.
Are there any special guest performances or dance groups that are participating this year?
We have the four Nisga'a Village dance group and the Nisga'a Urban Local dance groups from Terrace and Prince Rupert as well. So, yes, really just an opportunity to get together in song and dance.
What was the decision for the Lac La Zap Community Center to be host to the celebration?
The Lac La Zap Community Center is a nice, modern, comfortable space that allows for people to settle and enjoy the culture. So, yeah.
And they're kind of central in the Nass Valley, right?
Yeah, so we're about 146 kilometers northwest of Terrace. So it's about an hour and 45-minute drive into the Nass Valley. Yeah, folks can come and enjoy just sightseeing. There's a lot of other attractions in the area, including the Nisga'a Museum that's located in the village of Lac La Zap as well.
Looking ahead, what are some of the long-term goals for the Jai Jamboree Culture Celebration?
So it's going to be the third annual. So really, we want to make it a long-term annual event where we hope it will grow and flourish, become an attraction for folks of all walks of life to come and enjoy.
Is there anything else you would like to share or add at all?
I think the fact that we welcome everyone to come and enjoy the Nass Valley, all it has to offer. And we look forward to sharing in culture with not only the Nisqually Nation, but others that want to come and join us.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You could see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
There were tears, anger, and lots of memories shared in Cabot Square on Wednesday as Montrealers paid their respects to over 30 people who've died since 2021, all of whom experienced homelessness.
I miss them so much. I miss everyone. I got no more.
I know most people think that, oh yeah, they're out in the streets, they're lazy, they don't want to work. That's not the fact. There's a story behind that. There's trauma behind it.
This is Maggie Cispadio, lead intervention worker at Resilience Montreal, a local day shelter supporting the folks around Cabot Square. They co-organized Wednesday's vigil with the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal.
These were the people that were the strongest people I know personally, and that survived on the streets and that knew how to live on the streets. You know, for me, I know it's not easy living on the streets. You know, it's the danger to it and the addiction that comes with it. Sometimes it's just too late because of the addiction they have.
She says that people are often just trying to survive with the cards they've been dealt. But this can lead to dangerous situations and preventable deaths.
A lot of them will walk around at night or use just to stay up for their safety. Like one of our clients that was a regular was found in at the metro station in a washroom. You know, he didn't need to die like that. He was promised, I don't know about the promise, but to have a home because he was living under the bridge. You know, one of the people, and it was too late. We could have found and worked together as a team and worked hard to get him where he needed to get.
Most of the ceremony on Wednesday was for sharing memories of the folks who've been lost. Vanessa Laprise says she knew three of the people being honored.
Mohawk Mike took care of a lot of people. There's too many stories to tell. When he was alive, he was somebody that, and they all knew me through him. Nobody can touch me if he's around. Nobody can even look at me. Melanie was like a sister to me. She came to stay with me while she's going in and out of her boyfriend's. Help me out, cook, clean, take care of my son, you know? And I still had a place. She doesn't know that I'm homeless now because it was in December when I became homeless due to the system and nothing of what I've done. Melanie just got her place and she wrote me a message and said she just got her own place and her own TV and her own space. And then I found out about her passing. I still don't know how she passed away. I don't normally ask. I don't like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, I know pretty much everyone on the board. And it's almost like, where do you get started?
Speaking now is Resilience's David Chapman. He says that many of the issues that push someone to live on the streets are getting worse.
People say, well, why is there like 36 people now on these boards? And why is that? And it's a number of factors that compound together, okay? So one is a housing crisis and the inaccessibility of housing. And for the homeless population, it's almost impossible because often they don't have references and, you know, a great credit. And so they're going to be at the bottom of the priority list for any new apartments coming open. Also, there's the rise of like fentanyl. The third factor is you have in Quebec, and particularly in Montreal, this policy where there's a continual pattern of clearing encampments without a real destination. Okay, so what happens is, for example, the situation under the Ville Marie Bridge last year that Resilience was quite involved with, you had a number of people living under that bridge, and they had, as a small community, a little bit of safety in community, other people to watch their stuff, other people with naloxone kits, should you overdose. And we warned that if you just boot them out without a real destination, where they're going to end up is in a more dangerous circumstance. They're going to be alone in abandoned buildings, or, you know, in dark alleyways or in tunnels under the city, or further away in forested areas alone. And what's going to happen? Well, much more likely they're going to overdose. And big surprise, within less than a year, Matthew O'Donohoe here, who was living under that bridge, died hidden away of an overdose, as we predicted. And, you know, no one's ever held accountable for this kind of stuff.
There's anger as well as sadness at Wednesday's vigil because of a sense that advocates aren't being listened to by the folks in power.
Like this girl right here, Natasha, I went with her to the new lovely mega hospital by Vendôme that should be the latest and the greatest. She didn't have her health card and she was in really rough shape, and she's here, she's getting hassled at the front desk at the hospital for not having a health card. And this is precisely why she's avoided going to the hospital for so long in the first place. And not only is she hassled, but she's hassled right in front of me, who, you know, is an intervention worker, and I got my little Resilience Montreal shirt, so you'd think they might be on their best behavior, you know. But that's a really common narrative. A lot of the young Indigenous women on this board died of preventable illnesses that, you know, if they were caught much earlier, they wouldn't be dead. And yet, one of the challenges is that they don't have confidence in how they're going to be treated when they go to the hospital. And the problem is that we still live in a province where the premier's, you know, just denying systemic racism. And so it's a pretty steep hill to climb, is what I'm saying.
Organizers stressed again and again that they want a Resilience in every borough in the city. LaPrise says that for folks experiencing homelessness, that support can be life-saving.
Just for a part for my Indigenous community. If you're listening, and up above, I love you. Thank you for being a part of saving me too, and having this life to live here on Earth and still being here. They have a big part of why I'm still here. Or I'd be on that board too, and Resilience. If Resilience wasn't here, there would be a lot more of us on that board.
I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Dawaluan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The BC Assembly of First Nations is hosting a climate leadership engagement session in Terrace on June 5th. CFNR spoke with Terry Teagee, Regional Chief for British Columbia Assembly of First Nations, about the upcoming event. He says they aim to address climate change and other emergencies within First Nations community, and he stresses the importance of engaging leadership, environmental administrators, and those with emergency experience to gather information, share resources, and identify implementation strategies. The sessions are open to all 204 First Nation communities, which seek to overcome bureaucratic hurdles and maximize resource utilization. Teagee encourages attendees at upcoming sessions in Terrace, Chilliwack, Campbell River, and Haida Gwaii to foster collaboration and develop effective responses to climate-related challenges.
Terry Teagee, Regional Chief for the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations.
Coming up, they're going to be hosting the First Nation Climate Leadership Engagement Sessions.
Yes, that's correct.
What's the reason for holding these different sessions in the various different communities?
Well, I think, you know, this is really part of the BC First Nations climate strategy in terms of engaging with First Nations. And I think, moreover, it is looking at to really, I think, more towards implementation. We understand what the issues are. We understand what is going on within our First Nations communities in terms of climate change. And beyond that, we need to really start beginning to think about how best that can occur. How best can that really, I suppose, engage in terms of rubber hitting the road and part of the whole perspective from First Nations, especially the last few years in terms of climate change, the many fires, emergencies that we've been seeing. It's really important to get a better understanding of how best to engage or implement the strategy itself.
So for these gatherings, who are you hoping that will try and attend these events?
Well, I think for in terms of engagement, who should attend is First Nations leadership, especially chiefs and councils. And further to that is, I would say, First Nations environmental administrators and those that are really part of the environment, and also those that have experience and or have knowledge of emergencies are really important to attend these sessions, which are will give the, I suppose, a better understanding of how best to move forward.
So this event here is going to be open not just for these communities that are listed, but pretty much anybody who's willing to attend?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you register. We do have posters, social media on our website. I think it's more catered towards First Nations communities and nations. Really, I think it's open to all 204 First Nations communities that are dealing with climate issues, but also other emergencies, you know, such as floods, other emergencies that are out there that are communities that are trying to deal with. I mean, if we look at the current opioid crisis, we look at the crisis of homelessness, we look at the crisis of, we just came out of a pandemic. I think it's really necessary to better understand how best to utilize a lot of the resources we do have, but also increase the resources that we need, especially in terms of emergencies in regards to climate change.
So it's more than just information gathering from First Nations, but you're also providing information for them as well?
Well, certainly providing information and providing also getting direction how best to move forward. I think it's really important to better understand what are the best practices out there. But more importantly, I think what is necessary is that we get a good understanding how best to move forward. Because right now, you know, we've definitely had a number of sessions over the last several years. We know what the issues are. So how best can we implement some of these strategies? And certainly part of that is cutting down a lot of the red tape and bureaucratic impediments to how First Nations can better service their communities in terms of emergencies.
Is there anything else you'd like to share or add at all?
Yeah, this is one of 8 sessions. Terrace on June 5th are sessions that are coming up that potentially that many can attend to. And at the end of June 27th in Chilliwack in Stolo Territory, and then Campbell River on Vancouver Island on July 3rd. So in terms of sessions that are coming up, Haida Gwaii, June 3rd, and Terrace, June 5th, is, you know, sessions that are happening in in the Northwest Coast.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CGSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.